The following is a production of Vanderbilt's Owen Graduate School of Management. For more information about Owen, please visit owen.vanderbilt.edu.
The Parthenon Group is a worldwide leader in strategic advisory and private equity. Since 1991, it has helped set the pace of this fast-growing industry. We're lucky to have with us today someone who is an integral part of Parthenon Group's success. And as partner and chief economist for the group, he serves as an expert analyst of the U.S. and the world economy. He has served in senior positions in business, government, and educational entities, and as a professor of Harvard and MIT. For over 20 years, he led the Dignified Economic Research Group at Standard & Poor's Data Resources, which some of you I'm sure have heard of before. And he holds a BA from Kalamazoo College and a PhD from Harvard. He's here to speak to us about utilizing economics in strategy consulting and in private equity. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Roger Brenner.
Confused about the time here. So we're going to be going through some of this pretty fast, but I hope to allow you time for some questions as well. The topic really is based on my experience in the last 10 years. I arrived at this strategy consulting firm because the founder and I had this vision that when you need to know where an economy or an industry was going, instead of polling the equity analysts, you might do some original research. And so that was the initial thrust. But the more I worked there, the more I realized that I was really the missionary among the pagans, bringing the gospel of economics to the undereducated MBAs, to be truly insulting to all of you. But at the same time, I've learned a tremendous amount from those MBAs. And that has made this just a fascinating 10 years. I love my previous life as a pioneer building macroeconomic models and industry models, but actually taking it to an individual client setting is very rewarding. And so I hope to give you a flavor of how my teams now work with the strategy teams and the client teams in a selected set of areas. There are actually more that I could talk about, but I'm going to try and touch on several of these during, you know, I guess I'll allow about 35 minutes before I turn it over to Q&A. So there's the obvious situation, I said, of market growth forecasting. By sales benchmarking, I mean tearing apart a company's historic performance, taking out the acquisitions, looking at the organic growth, splitting it into price and volume, and seeing how that matched against true market measures. And very few companies do this. They'll often tell me, A, oh, the acquisitions are so complicated, I couldn't possibly give you an organic history. So we show them how to do that. And then I'll say, okay, now, since it's critically important for your profit growth, whether your revenue growth came from price or volume, give me your history on prices. Duh. No, we haven't thought about that, sir. Or something less dignified than sir. And so I developed the pricing practice at Parthenon. We also get often asked, come in and help us figure out how to downsize this sales force or optimize this. And what we often find is they shouldn't downsize, they should actually expand. They just haven't been able to figure out historically who was actually achieving good market share results in their territory and who not, and how to dig through the data to find that out. So that's what I'm talking about there. Now, a natural outgrowth of that is understanding for a chain, whether it's Famous Footwear or Papa Murphy's or Build-A-Bear Workshop or a whole bunch of specialty retailers in the restaurant, traditional retail or beer, other sectors, figuring out what has driven the results in a territory. How much of it is structurally fixed because of the demographics and economics of that area? How much of it is operationally driven by things ranging from sales force tenure to advertising effort? And believe it or not, when you take a time series cross-section set of data, you have got a wonderfully rich experiment that just begs for multivariate regression analysis. So if you haven't learned multivariate regression analysis, do. Because that's what I'm going to show you, how much you can tear apart data to get real answers on all of these, including what drives share prices. I could be really nasty right now and ask three of you victims, tell me what drives share price. But I won't. I'll just tell you and then let you figure out whether you agree with me. And then finally, we'll do some stuff on pricing. So, I've got this slide that basically says, you need to assess the impact of the economy and all of these other factors on results. You cannot get a decent answer looking at any results, whether it's profit, revenue, volume, price, by looking at pairwise with one of these factors. You will always get the wrong answer. Marketing and advertising firms will do these silly comparisons of what's the growth rate in the quarters leading up to your campaign? How does that quarter's growth rate differ from the average of the previous quarters? That's the impact of the advertising campaign. BS, because some other things have changed too. And if you don't control for them, you'll get some silly answers. Now, this is my multi-purpose slide, because depending on what business I'm pitching, that will be the first line. So I just had a Nashville client, and my first pitch was, you need to simultaneously assess the impact of magnitude and timing of advertising media choices, and that I moved economy down and advertising up. So I firmly believe you can't do it one-dimensional at a time. All right? Now, I told you already about forecasting. We really believe that you have to take it away from a black box of a regression done by an econometrician, which the management won't trust. Or if they do trust, they probably made a mistake because it was probably done fairly poorly. It was looking for a correlation, but one that was too narrow, couldn't be trusted to persist in the future. You really want to look for causation, and you want to build that in a collaborative framework so that you've taught them how to fish. All right? So the key things that you have to do so they achieve ownership and can make use out of it is agree on what are the right concepts that cause, not just correlate, they cause the result. Then, once you've done that, the statistical procedures help you figure out the timing and magnitude of the impacts. All right? So, this was one example. My first month at Parthenon. The team came to me and they said, we've got this company that's been bought by one of our longtime clients out of bankruptcy. They say that they have this theme, this is the way they identify themselves in the market of, we have the best price, and yet they know that they've got to close a bunch of stores and they haven't a clue why some stores are performing differentially from others. So my MBA team gave me a set of four slides. Right? First one says, well, we think tenure may matter. And you look at this scale, these are actual data points, these are not phony. These are two true slides. So the store revenue varied from 10 to 45, and you can kind of see this southwest, northeast diagonal, but look at that. Let's take Salesforce tenure, 2 years, some at 15, some at 40. What else is going on? What about the income of the area surrounding it? Well, you can fit a regression through that. There is kind of a wedge. But you shouldn't. What about the location? Are urban better than suburban? Well, the average of the suburban is higher than the urban, but that's not really too helpful, is it? And finally, what about square footage? Is a bigger store better? What's our optimum store size? Can you find it on that chart? No. So what you do is you start doing regressions. Now, to try and explain what a regression is, this is kind of what a regression does. What I've done here is just take a two-dimensional view of the world, look at the sales versus the tenure of the employees. And I divided the stores into three classes, high-income communities, middle, and low. And you run the three regressions now, and you get the three dashed lines, and notice how the impact of rising tenure is much more important the higher the income level. So you start thinking that these aren't necessarily additive effects. These are multiplicative, interactive. And one of the things I teach my teams is that after you've conceptually laid out what matters, then you better have the right functional form, the right mathematical form, so that things that interact, interact. And I terrify them by forcing them to do these regressions on a log-log basis. Log-log means they're multiplicative in their natural kind of format. So if you think that you've escaped in high school from logarithms, don't come to work for Parthenon. It'll be part of your life, because we really believe these factors interact. And this is just one simple way of showing you that. So let's talk about a more recent case. This is a client who came to us 5 years ago when they were owned by the private equity firm came to us and said, we've got a problem. The street, because they're still private, the management thinks that they are an experiential concept and the customers might tire. Been there, done that, don't come back. And so this is 2002 and our comp store sales are down. And that seems to confirm the notion that their experience is waning. Well, there was an alternative called the economy, right, 2002? And they actually hadn't been very consistent about their advertising. They also wanted us, by the way, if you can, during the course of this project, figure out where we should locate our next stores. So what we did was to take a pooled time series of all of their data by store, by quarter, you know, and figure out what drove same store performance. And luckily, they had had a rich experiment on the types of media that they use. So we could build this model and identify for them all of the impacts of the economy, the life cycle of their stores, how they could offset things or multiply them through media. And that's what we wanted to do. So these were the key factors that we actually built in to this single equation. Now, since it is this nice multiple year, multiple store cross-section, you got a lot of data. You can actually tease out 10 plus effects. And so we did. You've got the external, you've got the internal. We can identify for them what's the cannibalization of a store located within 3 miles, 5 miles, 10 miles of other stores. That helps a lot on store location, right? We also, as you'll see, we're able to discriminate between whether it's women's or children's television on which they're advertising, and whether the message is a call to action. This stuff, whatever, is available now for 3 weeks, never again, versus it's a wonderful experience to come to our store, try it sometime. And so all of those things could be filtered out. Oops. And as when we got through with that, we create charts like this. This is an example of the way you can communicate econometrics to management. You say, as we look at the variation of your factors, this is the months of 2004, for example, we can show you how each of those factors, compared to a year earlier, moved your sales. The green one, the unemployment rate, we show that at the beginning of 04, it was perfectly neutral. By the time you got through here to the fourth quarter, it was adding about 6 or 7 points to your comp store growth. Now, in 2004, almost everybody knew the economy was recovering, and if you didn't take account of your advertising, you might grossly exaggerate the effect of the economy. Because look what the total top scores were doing. Well, that's the need for this simultaneous modeling, okay? And to make them feel comfortable that the answer we gave them was true and validated by other information. Because I always feel I have to do that with econometrics. I'm always proving that. So we always marry it with market research, with surveys of customers and salespeople, to triangulate to a believable answer. In this case, I also looked at a set of categories the government tracks. They track about 60 different consumer categories. I added up seven of them that were similar in the discretionary nature based on my experience of working with these different firms. And then I showed them just in a graph of how, as the unemployment rate moves, so goes wage income naturally, since employment's moving. And with a multiplier, so goes consumer spending on such categories. And if you look at the scale here, the change in the unemployment rate from top to bottom is 3 points. The growth rate here from top to bottom is 13. So about a 4-to-1 multiplier. 1 point of unemployment change, 4 points of growth. In their model, the coefficient was 5. So I could say to them, this is the impact for you, and I'm pretty confident of it because you're like these people, but you're a little more discretionary. Good? It's a much more convincing story when you do it that way. And then, this was a presentation to their board, as well as their strategy group, saying, so what's ahead for you? And this presentation was made here. The blue chip is a survey of 50 economists. This was their outlook with the unemployment rate expected to rise, but some uncertainty. So I took the model's coefficients times this range and said, here's your challenge. By then, this company was public. Actually, I'm congealing about 6 years worth of projects, 2 per year, into the same presentation here. A repeat customer is a wonderful thing. All right? So, you know, they were cruising along in 06, early 06, with the economy adding about 2 points per year to comp store growth. And I told them most likely it was going to go from +2 to -1. And the street will go absolutely nuts with that. And it could be even worse. It could be -3 if the more gloomy versions go on. So, you've got this lens into the future. What do you do about it? What would you do about it? Not hypothetical. One of you gets to answer that question. Some of you are going to be in retail. If somebody came to you and said, your comp store sales are going to go from +2 to -1, and the street will freak, do you go tell the street so they think you're smart and you warn them and the sell-off happens earlier than later? Do you say, well, I know this is true. When the street freaks, I'll take it private again. Right? Or do you say, we also know how much we'd have to spend in advertising to offset that 3 to 4 point swing, so should we just do that? Because the simple-minded people on the street will just say, what are your comp store sales story? That's it, done. As long as we also know that it costs this many dollars to get this many sales with a profit margin of this minus the cost of the advertising, net we're ahead. You do that kind of math. So they decide to take option C. We had already this rich set of history on television advertising placement, and we'd already built a model that told them for every 100 TRPs, what do you get for an impact, and how long does it last? Whoops. Sorry. So, for example, we showed them that national versus local, about a 2.5-to-1 differential, and the national has a tail that lasts about 4 months. The branding versus call to action, about 1-to-2. So national call to action, bingo, that's where you put your money. That's how much it will generate in sales versus how much it costs. And so we said, look, your spending was $37 million. We think that you have to go up to 41 to get a 2% comp store sales gain. Where should you stick it and when? All right? And it worked. So they did. All right? So that's one example. And they use this for their business forecasting, for their real estate decisions, for their marketing decisions, for the share buyback, you name it. Nothing like this could have been done without multivariate regression analysis. Period. You would have been totally misled by thinking that things were economy or advertising when they were sum of both. All right? Now, here's another one where I'm sure you can't figure out who I'm talking about here. All right? Internet auction. All right? They didn't know how much their outbound marketing mattered. They were riding this wonderful penetration curve. That our first assignment with them, I'll dance to the music if you'd like. You don't want. I can't dance. Our first assignment with them was during the internet bubble. And Meg Whitman was talking with our founder, and the notion that they came up with was, Brinner's done all this analysis on what drives internet valuations and what drives conventional valuations, and that the two will merge within 3 years. So what do we need to be 3 years from now in terms of revenue and EBITDA to justify the price we have today? And with a hell of a lot more than collectibles. And then through market research, we were able to figure out that they could be, as they are today, the nation's largest seller of cars and a whole bunch of other categories. And we set a target for them of $3 billion from well less than $1 billion, and they beat it by 30%. So you have to kind of use, you know, a little bit of understanding what the market expects and how you get there. But one piece of it was, how can you drive it? So here is TV GRPs, and we told them how much you can drive your page views. What about outbound emails? And we even could dig in and show kind of diminishing returns and what the impact is on their page views. We wowed them with this regression that showed if you take all your price tranches, we can predict monthly with tremendous certainty what the sales are. Now this looks like a great accomplishment. You can get 90% of the way to this with seasonal factors and a time trend. But if you don't even know to try that, and know that it's likely there is such regularity, you'll never find the answer. So we got 90% of their way there with internet penetration and seasonality, and the rest of the way with pricing and marketing. And we gave the same kind of contribution charts, and we also present them this way. Sometimes they like bridge, you know, all the consultant standard tools. You can display things. You have not seen from me yet, nor will my customer ever see, a regression printout with coefficients, t-statistics, standard errors, R-squares. You'll never see it. Right? That just makes them scared. All right? Now, what about what drives share prices? Okay, I am going to ask you now. What do you think differentiates one industry from another, and within an industry, one firm for another, in driving its share price? This must have happened in your finance classes. Yep. Growth rate of?
Revenues.
Revenues.
Risk.
Volatility of earnings, the environment, and the like. Okay. Scratching or have an idea? Yep.
Profit margin.
Profit margin, sure. So it's revenue, earnings, risk, other things? Yes? Sure, and then there's a sense of what's the state of the economy, because that'll affect overall equity valuations, so the environment for equities.
Regulation,
and possible changes in regulation, things that will twist you around.
Cyclicality,
Sure, the cyclicality. So the volatility in general, but the type that can actually be tied to the stage of the business cycle. Excellent. You see the herd saying the economy is about to turn, time to move out of autos and into consumer staples, right? Or vice versa. Definitely. Well, I have to compliment you. Many times I do this, and before I get to the correct answers, every one of which was your answer, I'll get return on invested capital. EVA, the return on equity minus the weighted average cost of capital. I'll get all these wonderful finance theories, that don't work, okay, in any useful way. My daughter has taught me that if you Google Roger Brenner, you get this quote that scientists use to bash one another with. I just tossed it off one day about 20 years ago in a speech, and the scientific community loves to bash one another as they present papers, saying, Professor so-and-so, the plural of anecdote is not data. You haven't proven a thing. So that's my one claim to fame, other than being Dewey's friend, according to my daughter. So we like to take multivariate regression to give you some guidance. So here was a case of a clothing retailer who had a CFO who said, I've got a major problem. Slow growth, all volume, no price. We've exhausted all the outlets that we can add stores in the US, and we haven't figured out how to operate internationally. We don't have a clue how to improve our margins, but we're expected to grow income, and we're supposed to deliver better returns than we have. So, can you help us understand why we're valued the way we are, whether we deserve it, what we have to be to deserve something even better? How do you change everything you listed? The only one you left out was financial architecture. Debt, leverage, dividend policy, all those kind of things. So, in a perfectly unabashed effort to please the CEO, we create this chart, which shows that before he came in February 04, the shares sucked, and after he came in, well, you know, but in fact, if you start the index about here, nothing different, right? So, you know, you call in your investment banker and they will give you the following four charts, maybe, but probably. Let's look at your income statement, shares, debt, all this, and figure out what you've been doing. We'll look at your shareholder returns and figure out where you are within this, and gee, yeah, you really haven't done very well. and of course, the old favorite, what's your PE? Well, you're a little bit below average at 20.8 versus 23.3. So with our guidance as investment bankers, we'll get you up to 24 or whatever. Trust us. But there isn't any analysis that says why Sears is 9.3, Dillard's is 48.8, and they're 20.8. It's just there's a wide range of variation. And of course, you know, the standard approach to these charts is there will be annotations, little arrows going down that such and such happened on this date, right? That's anecdote, right? And the plural of it isn't analysis or data. So what we did was to build a model. Now you've already heard my sermonette, you didn't even need it. This is, you know, an investment banker or a strategy consultant who's selling EVA or something else will produce a chart like this. And you can do market cap versus NOPAT versus earnings versus two-year average ROIC versus, right? And you can find a wonderful correlation. Well, how about this for a little forensic accounting? Why does the market-to-book ROE model work as well as the PE versus EPS growth? If you work through the arithmetic, they're the same. They both are saying that what you want is the company PE and expected earnings growth. They're highly correlated. Okay? So, one other client didn't believe this, so we showed them, well, here's your five-year forecasted growth, and there's the ROIC and EV. No correlation with one. Tons of correlation with the other. All right? So here's our model. We say it's actually very systematic. It's very simple. The first thing you do is you say, there's a market environment. Thank you. Right? A couple of you said that. How richly are equities in general valued because of a sense of risk, accounting fraud, economic uncertainty. That sets a general PE one because you've got to compete against bonds as well. So you've got that as a factor. And then you say, within the universe, say large cap, how does this industry sit? Where is it in the economic cycle? What's its long-term as well as its short-term prospect? That will give it a premium or a discount to the overall market PE. And then, what about your company within industry? Depending on your relative revenue growth, earnings growth, financial architecture, things you control, you'll get a relative premium or discount to your industry, which has a premium or discount. It turns out this simple logical structure, which you folks nicely already understand, works econometrically beautifully. Here is fitted versus actual share prices for 7 years for every one of these major retailers. Look at the tremendous variety of performance. I did not fit each company separately. The coefficients for revenue earnings have to be the same for every company, and it's only their differential performance, the company-specific risk or expectation that differs. And you can explain all of these wild movements of our client, Nordstrom, all the others. And I'm showing you here actual and fitted. It works. Now, I have done this for one of the largest and most successful hedge funds in the country. They hired me to look at the 500 most actively traded stocks in the U.S. We divided them in the 250 that I felt this economics-dominated model would work versus ones where regulatory change, scientific innovation would disrupt it. So I took those 250, I divided them into 20 industries, built 20 models like this. And what they do is systematically go long on the ones where I say they're undervalued and go short on the ones paired up within the industry so they don't even have an industry risk. They don't have a market risk. So remember my chart? It's a multiple of three things. And by the way, do forward expectations of earnings matter? No. If you put back the history, the most recent 1 and 2 years of revenues and earnings, that's all that matters. And if you put in addition to those, the analyst expectations disappear because they've done nothing other than draw a ruler in both cases through the two historic data points. So there is no value added. So you don't even need to have a forecast. All you have to do is look backwards 2 years. So we gave the coefficients and everything for all of these. And then we showed them that if you look at the positions within the peer group and you compare that to what the traditional investment accounting would be, guess what? It's all validated. So you get them comfortable in their own language, their own culture, their own analytical framework, and then you say, there is a more powerful tool that makes sense, and here are the answers. Okay? The last thing I really have time to take you through is kind of a similar quick application where we're trying to understand performance of the different pieces of a firm. So this is pure cross-section, all right? We wanted to find out what they could do locally and nationally to improve it. So naturally, we built an econometric model. The answer is always, you build an econometric model. Right? See here, I blocked out the actual data. And this just shows you what the range of variation is, market share by territory. There are 800 distinct exclusive territories. The lowest market share is 20, the highest is 80. Huge variation, all selling exactly the same product. Exactly. So what could drive 60 versus 80? Well, the answer is you've got to know the structural and the actionable. And what we did to create that is this. Let's talk about in structure. What's the the ethnic, the demographic composition of this wholesaler's population base? What are local regulations? What's the account mix? How much is it convenience stores versus grocery stores? Because if you're the big kid, you want the convenience store market because they're only going to carry a limited number of brands. You don't want the liquor store, grocery store model that will carry everybody. So you need to know all that. And you can't change that by and large. What you can change are the things on the right. And so what we did was to build this econometric model. At the end of it, it allowed us to add across all those factors, sum up across the bottom, how many percentage points of market share deviation from the median are due to the intrinsic structural characteristics of the market, and how many are due to the controllable. And then we just plotted everybody's point. Well, the blue dotted line says you'll come out at a 50% market share anywhere along that because the goodness of your market offsets the ineptness of your operation, or vice versa at the top, right? But think about it. Everybody who is above that blue line prior to this analysis was a hero of some dimension in the eyes of corporate. They had a better than average market share. And everybody below was a villain pleading with corporate to understand that it's not me, it's my market. And some of those people were right. But some of those people were dead wrong, it was them. So, you know, here are the people regarded as heroes, but in fact they were gross underperformers. Here are the people who were villains, but in fact heroes because they were trying more. Right? So you just decompose everything that way, and then we create waterfalls to show them. But also along the way, we could do neat stuff like showing that the bang for the buck of your advertising spending wasn't constant. If you had a low share of voice, talking mattered and helped. If you already were drowning out the competition 4-1, another billboard did little. So the bang for the buck slopes down like this. What about how friendly the territory is to your portfolio of products based on demographics, job, all the other structural things? Well, if you're preaching to a choir that's ready to be converted, they'll buy. And if you're talking to somebody who says, I'm a yuppie, I only drink imports, and you're not going to change me, right? That you're going to have a slope. So since we had quantified the playing field, we actually were able to build that in the model. We showed that in the adverse playing fields, a dollar got you 1/3 the impact of the big playing fields. So it was pretty easy for us then to build an Excel model that said, take your $500 million advertising budget and grossly readjust it. Instead of spreading it out level, overplay your hand where you're underplaying it, change it to just selling more where your products are accessible, or you have a portfolio of 65 different beverages. Present ones that match your demographics. Right? And by the way, advertising prices are not set by their applicability to your product. They're set by the value of a whole range of consumer companies trying to grab a billboard, a minute of television space. We've told you which ones are going to buy you the most bang. So let's also adjust it by the cost of a minute in a given market and pull you out of the expensive markets where you're already talking too much and they don't want to hear you. It was pretty simple. We showed them that a $25 million reallocation would bring them $180 million of extra profit. And we charged them $500,000 to do the project. And it was scalable, totally scalable. We told them 25 of their 500 million. Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed talking with you.